This is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm with Mr. Buddy Bush. Today's date is January the 11th, 2000. It's hard to say 1999, but it's the year 2000. And we are in the library meeting room, and we're just going to ask him a few questions about his memories of Dibon. Mr. Bush, if you can, just start by telling us your full name and when and where you were born.
Okay, well, my full name is E.H. Bush, Jr. I will use initial, but I never liked the name.
What is the name?
But the name is Elbert.
Elbert, okay.
And I was born in Lufkin, September 23rd, 1928. My family was living in Dibon at the time. I was probably one of the few children here at that time that was born in a hospital, because my mother was in some kind of illness. I felt like it probably worked better in a hospital.
Mm-hmm. Who were your parents?
It was E.H. Bush and Minnie Jackson Bush. My mother was from Dibon. I don't think she was not born in Dibon, but my grandfather was a sawyer. And
at one of the mills?
Yeah,
in Dibon?
Yeah, Dibon, right. And he was sort of a temperamental man, and he tended to move around a lot because he would get mad at his employer. They get mad at him, whatever. Anyway, he moved quite a bit. However, by the time he moved to Dibon, he was pretty well settled down. I think they moved here around the turn of the century. I'm not sure exactly when they moved here.
So what you're saying is he'd worked at other mills before Dibon?
Oh, yeah, he'd worked. And I think back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, particularly sawyers tended to move around between mills. Because he had worked in Louisiana, he'd worked in I know Carr, because if I get through here today, I was going down there to take some pictures of some tombstones.
Because
I've been doing, because he's buried there.
Yeah.
And I've been doing some work on my ancestors, trying to see how far back I could get. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of that.
Where was your mother born?
I don't really know. Let's see, Pawnee, Louisiana, which doesn't exist anymore.
But it was a sawmill town?
It was a sawmill town, yeah. And when she, like most of the county seats, or in the case of Louisiana, parish seats, the courthouse burned, of course, and the record of her birth burned. So when she started to apply for Social Security, she had to find people that had known her. And I remember her saying that she was born at Pawnee, Louisiana.
And tell us a little bit about your early memories of Dibon. Born in 1928.
Yeah.
Of course, you kind of grew up during the Depression.
Yep. Well.
Your parents were living at Dibon
right,
at the time you were born. You just were born in the Lufkin.
Right. My dad was a school teacher. And he was, I guess, when I was born, he was teaching. I don't know if he was teaching here or not. We did live in a little while in Louisiana. I don't remember living anywhere except Dibon at that time, but I know we were in Louisiana. And, my first memories of it was, in a comparative sense, it was a pretty ragtag looking place because most of the buildings had never seen a coat of paint. And the streets were all dirt streets. Now this is kind of a funny memory, but I remember I used to have to ride with my dad over to the quarters to pick up a black woman who came and did housework for my mother. And at the backside of the mill, they had a lot of lumber stacked up, and it looked like it had been there for a long time. It turned gray and purple. And that's strange why I remember that. It was one of those things really stuck in my mind. I thought they must never sell that stuff because it's been there so long.
The market was pretty bad.
It was, I guess. It was pretty slow. That lumber sure looked like it had been there for many years.
Many years.
Oh, that's strange.
What do you remember of school?
Well, school. Well, when I started the first grade, of course, it was across this little creek that was there. And we lived over on the highway. Right up here, actually.
The old
the
highway.
Story, yeah, the old highway. We lived down a little way. In fact, probably along about where the JP office is, okay. in that general area. And so I just walked to school. I had a little dog that would follow me over to school, and he'd stand in line with me while I went in the first grade. Well, then he'd go back home. And at lunchtime, he'd be there ready for me to walk home with me. I don't think the schools, well, of course, the schools were there, the old style building that you had in East Texas. Since there was no cooling in there, they had real high ceilings and high windows. And for heating, they would cut hardwood and bring it and pile it up out on a school yard. And there would just be worlds of hardwood out there for the stoves. And we used to build caves in those things and stuff. We had little caves running all through that hardwood. I guess the main thing I remember about the school, I only went to the third grade and part of the fourth grade here. And then we moved to Newton.
Newton?
Newton.
It's because your father?
Yeah, he
working.
For reasons which I don't understand, I don't remember, don't have any idea actually. He lost his job here and he moved to Newton. And then later on we moved to Buna, and then later on back here, and he became a coach. Well, he was actually junior high principal in Lufkin later on, so it kind of ran me, so.
I was going to ask you about the you brought us a photo just a while ago of the interior of the Believe It or Not cafe. Start to say Believe It or Not hotel, but it's just a cafe. Tell us a little bit about that, what you remember of that.
Well, I've always loved hamburger, and I thought that when we got in that cafe that I thought it was going to be a great deal because I could have a hamburger anytime I wanted one. And sure enough, but I finally got to where I was so tired of hamburgers. I couldn't look one in the face.
Yeah, yeah, your father and mother kind of ran it?
Well, yeah, I'm not real clear at this point exactly how it all worked, but my grandfather also helped him run it. He was a pretty good cook. And obviously my uncle.
That was Albert Jackson?
Yeah.
Was your grandfather?
Yeah, he was a good cook. And he cooked in there. I think Daddy really got into that after he lost his job at school. And I'm not sure how long that he just ran that cafe that I did for a while. And then he got the job at Eaton. So then my grandparents ran it for a while. And
I know you said you're a little unclear about all of it, but who actually owned the building?
I have no idea. The company, I would say, actually owned the building. Because I think that's true because after it quit being a cafe, I think they converted it to a residence. For years, it was still there.
Yeah, I think Mrs. Waltman. The first name.
Yeah,
but,
I believe that's right.
She had lived there for a while. And
I believe that's right.
And Mr. Nelson, Edwin Nelson, had told me that his father sort of either organized it or built it, but I never understood if he actually owned it or not.
No, I think all the buildings,
everything's
out except up in Coastown. The company owned all of them, and over, let's say, Press Holcomb owns the property over there. But other than that, all is in the company. I'm curious.
So you think that was part of the company business, and they just allowed?
Well, they just rented the building.
Just rented the building out. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like when the hotel was here. They owned it and rented it out of here. They could get the money.
Now, you also mentioned that your grandparents, your grandfather, Albert Jackson, had run the Antlers Hotel for a while. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, actually, I think originally it was he and my uncle, Buster.
Buster Jackson.
Yeah, that ran it.
And that was your mother's sister, brother?
Yeah.
Buster was? Okay.
Yeah, actually, my mother was how Daddy went, because my dad was from Louisiana. He had no connection to this area. But when he was going to Centenary in the summer, he would he'd play minor league baseball to make enough money to get him through college another year. And so he was playing in Leesville, and my Uncle Buster was playing baseball with another team, I think. And they got to be sort of friends. And so my mother was kind of came over to Leesville to visit with her brother and met my dad. And my daddy always said, you could never move East Texas girls out of East Texas. There was no use trying.
No use even trying.
So you were going to wind, you know, you wound up here. Wound up losing the eyeball. And as bad as the eyeball looked in the 30s, I tell you what, we thought it was the center of the world.
So you came back to the eyeball approximately what year? And then did you graduate from the eyeball high school?
Yeah, we came back here in 44. And I went my junior and senior year.
Okay. And you graduated in what year?
46.
46.
Yeah.
Then you mentioned you went into the service?
46.
46.
I graduated high school, I think, on about the 25th of May. And in a few days, Vernon Burkholder and I joined.
On the same day?
Well, we joined together. Of course, we weren't together for any period of time, but yeah. We did leave.
Just briefly, where are you during the service? How long were you there?
I went from here to Fort Sam Houston, and then to Fort Knox, Kentucky. Took basic training there, which was about 8 weeks. Came back on leave for about 2 weeks, and then I went to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. Got on a ship and went to Italy, and to Trieste, Italy. And was there for the rest of the time I was in the Army, which was from November 46 till about April or May, April, it was 1949.
49. So you got out before the Korean?
Just barely. I didn't realize, you know, so I got thinking about it, I didn't realize quite how close it was. Well, I think what, I would have sure been dismayed if I thought I was going home, and then all of a sudden I'm working out. But I came home, and decided to go to college since I was eligible for GI Bill. Mm-hmm. Went to Stephen F. Austin. And when the Korean War started, I was in the reserve, so I got recalled and was in the Army for a year. Well, not really a year. It was from probably about 9 months until we camped close to Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Certainly was not a bad deal.
I know you've done photography for quite a while. Did you get into that in the service, or?
No, I really didn't. I always kind of wanted to do it. I think it looked interesting to me. And anyway, I decided to buy myself a big camera. Mm-hmm. And actually, Edwin Nelson was the one that told Paul that I was doing photography. And Paul was looking for somebody to do some photography for the paper. And mainly, though, to do the processing of
the darkroom work, yeah.
And I had set up a darkroom and was doing all that stuff, so it was no real problem.
You were doing it at home?
At home, yeah. Okay. Well, I was living in Lufkin then. And in 62, we moved to the eyeball then on Carter Drive. And when we built our home, and when we built the house, I had a darkroom built into it. Hmm. Which was really nice.
So you built a home in Dyball?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was the most convenient dark room that I ever had, because I had everything built in. I put in a temperature control system. And so processing film I could do. Very easy.
So you were actually processing film before you moved to Dyball?
Yeah.
About when did you start doing work for Paul Durham and the News Bulletin? Did you do it back when it was that
I'm not real sure. I think
the News Bulletin started after the bus all ended about 52, and
yeah, it was after, let's see.
I can't remember now. When exactly the name
I just guess
Free Press.
Yes, I probably started processing all the stuff about 59 or 65
years. Okay.
I'd always do that. That's always sound like fun to be able to do your own enlargements and that sort
right.
of thing.
That's almost, I mean, you have, that's what I tell people a lot, there's almost, it's almost like taking another picture. You know, you capture the event on film, yeah, and then the processing and printing is right. You know, you've got as much exposure control there as you do.
When I first started processing, I got a funny thing happened. So we went out and took some pictures of our children, and at that time I didn't have any way to control the temperature of the water. So I adjusted my development time, made it shorter in order to compensate for the fact that the temperature was probably about 100 degrees. And I put it in the water and washed it. And then I hung it up to dry, and I looked up, and the gelatin had melted and started to run off.
It was starting to drip off. Yeah.
It was hot. So I said, well, got to do something different. This is not working real well.
Yeah.
And those pictures, they look kind of like you're looking through Jell-O or something. I printed it for a little girl.
Yeah, nowadays that'd be artistic. How'd you do that?
Serendipity.
Yeah, there you go. So when you had built the house, and were you actually doing most or all, or about how much were you doing for the newspaper, the processing work?
Doing practically all. I think all the processing, probably. Fair amount of photography.
Okay.
I was working at Temple White.
At the handle factory.
Yeah.
At the time. Also. So you're doing your photo processing on the side.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I spent nearly all my weekends working on photos, one way or another, and at night.
I haven't asked you about your personal family. You have a wife?
Well, yeah.
I've heard you say we. So.
Well, I'm married to the former Betty Wiley, Betty Sue Wiley, of course. Okay. It's not popular anymore to have two names. But she was a little girl at once. And she also was from Diabol. We knew each other in high school. And in fact, I dated her some in high school. But she was not the kind of girl I was looking for in high school. And she was actually a year ahead of me in school. She graduated in 45. That was because I was born on the 23rd of September, which meant that I was not quite 6 years old.
Right.
And my dad didn't believe in me getting into school too early, so he made me wait around another year.
I was born at the end of August, so I was always young for mine, and you were old for yours. Yeah,
right. And so we, like I said, we dated a little bit in high school, and then after I got out of the Army, she and her family had moved to Lufkin, and my dad and mother were living in London. So we got together and eventually married, three children. Karen, who's the oldest, and Mark, who works down here, was the middle child, and our youngest is Carol, who's a nurse practitioner in London. They're all right around. So you can't get rid of them.
Tell me a little bit about the handle factory. Working there. What was your job? Did you have several jobs?
I was the accountant.
Accountant.
Yeah. And I worked there 9 years. Probably the most miserable 9 years of my life.
Really?
Yeah. The
because of the job or just
the people who were the whites were. if they weren't crazy, they were pretty close. It's funny, the guy that I took his place was from Michigan. How he wound up in Diabol, I had no idea. But his name was Tom Kelly. And he was showing me the ropes, you know. And he said, well, I want to tell you this before I leave. He said, when I came here, see, the people out in the plant said, they asked me, he said, since you're not from this area, we want you to tell us what you think about the whites. I said, we think they're crazy. And he said, I told him, so well, you know, they couldn't be crazy and be running a fairly good sized business. And he said, but I have been here 3 years. And he said, I'm ready to tell you right now, by God, they're crazy. And that was my opinion on it too.
Yeah.
If they were crazy, they were not. If you had ever had a management school, these people would have been perfect examples of what not to do.
Why not?
Because they had a tremendous turnover.
Were they micromanagers or
They were just plain unpleasant about almost anything. And I was brought up in the old school, and the boss is right. And however, it didn't take me long before I had a round with his father, the old man, H.C. White.
H.C.
And it was Herb, who died recently, his son. I should have gone. I should have just gone on. But I like, I wanted to stay. It took me a while to decide that I was going to leave.
Well, when did the Handel factory shut down?
It was shut down in the 80s, I believe, yeah.
Okay. And so you left about?
I left in 72.
In 72.
Well, actually, I left before then. I left, let's see, about 1960. 65, I believe, because I worked at the Tex Lamp after that. But I had worked there from 56 to 65. I worked there.
What was the biggest part of the business then, as far as products? What were y'all making in the time you were there?
It was just handle.
Broom
and mop handle, yeah.
Did you ever make anything smaller, like hammer handles or anything like that?
No, you'd have to have hardwood. This whole business was based on the idea of using the waste from sawmills.
So you're just pine?
Pine, right. Because the yellow pine made an excellent handle for brooms and mops. But it was, like I say, based on utilizing waste. And what happened was they found other ways to utilize the waste that were a whole lot less trouble than making squares out of it. That's the particle board and all this stuff.
The fiber
once you didn't have to fool with it
wood
like
fiber
you did to cut those squares, because they'd take what was the edgings off of a log. And they could take it, cut a square out of it enough to make a handle out of it.
Right.
But later on, nearly all these companies found ways, better ways to utilize them. Besides, these people were hard to get along with if you were providing them with waste products, too, because they were just as difficult to deal with to their suppliers as they were their employees. And so they had a lot of trouble with the people that were supplying them with raw material.
That was kind of Edwin Nelson's job, from what
that
I
was
understand.
Edwin's, that's
to
right.
Travel all
Edwin,
around trying to get
right.
squares.
That was Edwin's job, was to kind of keep these people pacified. And of course, Edwin's a pretty good politician. And he would, but if White's ever dealt with them, they would probably pack up and leave. And they had a guy that I don't know if he's still in business now or not. I'm sure Edwin could tell you his name. It was Bill something or other. He drove by. And Edwin told me that during World War II, he had gotten this guy to make him squares for a couple of months. And he went over one day, and the guy had the machine all packed up for him to take. He said, Bill said, what did he do? He said, well, I figured out the money to be made is in handle. It's not in making squares. So he later became one of the major competitors. And, in fact, I think he had actually a bigger company than they did. And I think that's actually, in the end, that's what happened to Temple White, was they got to where the sawmills didn't produce enough waste. And you couldn't buy lumber and rip it up and make handles out of it and make money out of it.
Yeah, double the cost.
They were not good managers. They didn't look to the future. They didn't know they thought the future was going to be just like the past.
Yeah.
And it never does. You always kind of got to figure out what's going on and swim with it. I was certainly glad that I left when I did, because if I had stayed until the 80s, I wouldn't have been quite old enough to retire.
Yeah,
they went out there.
So you went directly from there to Tex Lamp?
Yeah.
Tell us about Tex Lamp. What did you do there? The same type of work?
Yeah.
County?
Yeah. I was in the county.
How many employees did Tex Lamp employ?
I don't remember. Maybe 100.
100?
Maybe.
Was it pretty steady work? I mean, was it seasonal, or did it just depend on contracts they had, or were they able to maintain?
They bid on contracts, since they manufactured laminated beams and arches and so on. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of cyclical, you know. If the economy got down, going downhill, the Texas land was slowing down. And Don Berlin was the president. And Don was a likable guy.
Say that last name again?
Burnley, B-U-R-N-L-E-Y.
Burnley.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had been a salesman at Temple. And I think he was sort of in tight with Arthur. And so anyway, when they had started out, they were partners with a family that actually had started the business in Houston. And they convinced them to move it up here. And I think Temple was still 50-50 partners with them. But they didn't make any money for a long time. And finally, Temple exercised their option to take it over completely. And that's when they put Burnley in charge of it. It was kind of, you know, it was kind of a funny story in itself, because, like I said, they had never made any profit. And
yeah, that's why, while it's here in Dipaul?
Yeah, they had always lost money.
Okay.
And so after I was there for about a year, I went and talked to the sales manager, and I said, how do you calculate what you're charging for this stuff? They had a formula you wouldn't believe. I mean, you could build an atom bomb, I think, probably a shorter formula. And it had been figured out by a previous sales manager. And it's one of those things, they were just continuing to use it without understanding, you know, the thing. And I told him, I said, well, because they had talked about putting them on a second shift and running two shifts, a night shift. And I told him, this guy was named Dick Dumas. No, this guy's name. John, he was my ranking, and I told him, I said, well, you can run this place 24 hours a day, but I said, no more than you're charging for it, you'll never make a profit. He said, well, we can't sell it and charge it for it. I said, well, okay, but you're just going to continue to lose money. And so this went on for about a year, and Rankin left, and they hired a new sales manager named Dick Dennis. And he came in there, and he said, I'd like to make some profit. He said, how much do I have to charge? What do I have to do to make a profit? And I told him, I said, well, if you'll mark it all up about 30%, you'll make a profit. And he said, okay. Within 3 months, they made the first profit they ever made. And of course, I mean, this is human nature, but Burnley, as soon as they made a profit, he hustled down to Arthur's office and told him he had performed a wonder up there and deserved a raise.
All it was just raising their
ridiculous. You wouldn't think that a company would run like that, but that's all it was. That's all it took. And so he went along for, I guess, 2 or 3 years doing very well, but then he got into a recession or a depression, and sure enough, you couldn't really charge that price and sell enough to do any good.
Were churches a big
churches
customer?
Churches were primary, yeah. There was a lot of people that were in, at that time, it was probably like jail builders are today. There were a lot of people that did nothing but build churches.
Yeah.
And the only problem you had with those guys was a lot of them would fly by night, too. They would buy your material, and they would build the church. They'd get the money, and they were gone. They never bothered to pay you. Mm-hmm. So that was an important part of it, was getting your money before these guys. Before they got away with what they owed.
Yeah. I know, I just saw the other day the front cover of the 1962 annual report for Southern Pine Lumber Company showed the interior of the First Methodist Church in Lufkin.
Yeah.
And said the
yeah,
Texas land.
Well, I know the one in Jasper, too, the First Methodist over there, because I was working there, I think, when I did that. And there's a big shopping center in Dallas, I think, Old Town and the Village, which I've never seen. But I think last year we were in business, that was a main source. That one, and it's bound to be, because that laminated stuff was beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's expensive, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I suppose the lumber came from the sawmill
yeah.
here in Dipaul?
Yes, it did.
Where do they get the glue?
Well, there was, basically, there was two kind of glue. There was casein, which is what you use to glue these in here. And I'm sure they're done, yeah, they're done with casein.
We're just looking at the rafters in the meeting room here.
Yeah, and the waterproof, which anything that you've got outside, they would use it. Although they did get screwed up occasionally, put the casein on the waterproof, and then when you did, it would look like a deck of cards, because when it got wet, it would all come out. I think the casein, we primarily got it from Ford. I'm not sure where the waterproof came from.
These here were probably made by Texan, I don't know.
I'm sure they were, yeah. I say I'm sure. I'm not really sure. They might have been.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I think the building was built in 62.
And, but Texan, I don't
believe
they were built. They might have been.
Yeah, I know, like I said, on the cover of the 62 report, it said...
Did it show?
It said by Texas.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
And like I think this was built in 64. So,
yeah, okay.
So I would imagine,
oh, yeah, 64,
I would imagine,
I'm sure they did.
Yeah. And then, I guess they glued them and then had to run through planers, huh? They had some big planers there?
Well, no, they didn't run through a planer because they were already planed.